Hello, and welcome to the Philosophical Angle Podcast with your host, author Chris Angle.
Hi, this is the Philosophical Angle Program, and I'm your host, Chris Angle. I'm the author of four books on philosophy, one of which is Defining Ethics, Good and Evil. And if you'd like to contact us and make comment, you can give us an email or make a comment below. And the email is contact@thephilosophicalangle.com. Along with me is my colleague and co-host, Rick Samuelson. Rick graduated from Yale and has MBAs from Wharton and Tufts, and he's an independent venture capitalist. And the purpose of the Philosophical Angle is to examine the nature of concepts and ideas in current media. And last week we saw the the Biden speech to the joint session of Congress. And my impression was that, coming away from that speech, is that President Biden and his Democratic associates don't like America. Seem to criticize it pretty heavily, especially about race. But they seem to definitely hate America in some cases. So we're gonna take a look at that. But in order for us to really go forward and discuss this, we need to decide, first of all, what is hate? So let's define hate. And hate is that which you dislike, and in addition to disliking it, you can't do anything about it. So you don't hate anything until you dislike it and cannot do anything about it. So what is it about the Democrats that make them hate America? In other words, they dislike America, plus they can't do anything about it, and that's why they hate America. So in order to proceed with that, now that we've established our definition of hate, we also need to understand how does the clock tick inside the Democratic liberal mind? So we're going to review that a little bit. We typically talk about that here, and we're going to bring up a little diagram on the nature of the political left and the political right, and so let's take a look at that. So the Democrats come from the haves of society, and because all political parties come about from having evolved from the haves or the have-nots. When you go back all the way back through other centuries, you see that all political parties they originated in two parts: those that have things and those do not. And originally, it was the king and queen that had things, and they took it from the serfs, they took it from the proletariats. And in modern day, as society grew, the haves, the king and queen and the nobles, they had to have their facilitators to help them out, and that was their nobles. And then in modern day, as society even grew more and more, they have to have not only nobles but associates now, facilitators, and these are the government bureaucrats. And in addition, the corporate, the government bureaucrats need to become friends with corporate management. And you see that constantly, how the government bureaucrats try to bring in corporate management, the president and the operators of the management of the corporation, because the large corporations have many people which pay taxes. And so you need these people to pay taxes, and so they incorporate the management into to being facilitators of the government bureaucrats, which are work with the kings and queens of society, and today we call that a president and Congress and the Supreme Court and the others that run society. And they run society, and all haves and all the governments, they all run society by controlling society. They make their laws and regulations, and they do this because they need to control society through their laws and regulations, and it's a natural thing for them to do, because then they can tax you or take what they want from the serfs and the proletariats and the slaves of society. And they do this because there are several dictums that control political behavior. Let's go over those. The first dictum is the law of the demand for the good. In other words, all of society, all of life demands that which is good for it. And just like the kings and queens of and government bureaucrats today and corporate managers, they all want that which is good for them. So they're willing to take what you have because it's for them to have it is better for them than it is for you. Second dictum of political behavior is St. Augustine's principle of libido dominandi, the will to dominate. And so the king and queens keep their domination. They dominate others, and the government workers will dominate others because that allows them to control and bring more to their coffers because they'll want more for themselves constantly and on an ongoing basis, because all life demands and continues to demand that which is good for it. And the third dictum, which we need to discuss here, is that the haves believe that the have-nots are not good. So over here is the third dictum of the have-nots are inherently not good, and this is the belief of the haves. And the fourth dictum, which we're going to discuss here in a second, is noblesse oblige, which means that the haves realize that they have to provide for the have-nots, because if they don't, the have-nots become too oppressed. Then they rise up, and things like the French Revolution happen, and suddenly the haves are on the guillotine. So they know that they can't make the have-nots downtrodden too much, otherwise they'll try to rise up. And throughout history, we've seen that. There's the basic setup of society, the haves with the have-nots. But the trouble is that first dictum gets in the way when for the have-nots. And for the have-nots, who are the serfs, the slaves, the worker bees, they want to break out and they want to create something that's good for society and be able to sell it and improve their lives. And so they try to break out of their serfdom, and they move out of there into a middle class, and then they form companies and do well and progress. But nevertheless, it's thought during all this process that the haves know that the have-nots are basically bad people, and then that nature is inherently bad. So they don't have much respect for the individual rights of the have-nots, even though they've climbed out and into the middle class. In the eyes of the haves, they're inherently bad people and need to be controlled. And they need to be controlled through negative knowledge, which are laws and regulations, plus force. And this is used to control the have-nots. And this necessarily control of the have-nots means that there will be economic and equal social justice of the have-nots, whereby everybody stays where they are in society, whereby everybody is equal in every way. And that's what they want to control. It's due to the noblesse oblige, dictum number four. They're going to keep them, they're going to provide for them, And for the leftists, these are the typical societies of the communists, the fascists, the socialists, and throughout history that have provides for the very basic necessities of the have-nots, which work to provide the wealth for the haves. So the have-nots are known as the deplorables. The haves, the have-nots, they jump out into the class of the haves. And to the haves, this is inexcusable. And it's inexcusable because they've jumped out of their category. And this causes a problem for the facilitators. And it sometimes it causes a really bad problem if there is a violent breakout, as we discussed about the, according to the revolutions that have happened throughout history. So they the haves are do not want that to happen. So they created the dictum number four, noblesse oblige, but that is violated when the serfs jump out. Because they're guaranteed minimum wage, and which is welfare, and the nobles had a loyalty to provide the minimum amount of basic necessities for life, and this nonconformity violates the contract. And so, and there's a second problem that develops, and the jump out into the, by the serfs causes a morality problem because the nonconformity causes an inequality in the serf class. Somebody's achieving more goodness for himself than the rest of the serf class. And therefore, this is an unethical action by these have-nots. And by going into the middle class, and the haves would view this nonconformity as unethical and deplorable. And they consider that deplorable because they are inherently bad. So they need to be controlled, and because the have-nots are bad and unethical, there is no need for the haves to cooperate with them anymore. And if there's no need to cooperate with them because they've broken out and they've violated the contract, they lose their ethical. It violates their ethicals to perform. The cooperative nature of providing them the their basic needs, and so that's why they begin to use the ends justifies the means rationality in dealing with the deplorables, and therefore Democrats feel that lying is okay when speaking to the deplorables. There's no need to be ethical. But something stands in the way of the left implementing their control over the lower classes, over the serfs. And that which stops them, and this is what causes the hate that the left has for the United States, because it is the U.S. Constitution that prevents them from totally controlling the lower classes. And what is it inside the Constitution that does it? Well, it's Amendments 14, 15, and 19, and Amendments 4, 5, 9, and 10, plus Article 1, Section 10 about being able to construct contracts. But these are the amendments, such as the law implying impairing the obligation of contracts, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor to be deprived of life, liberty, and property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Powers not delegated to the U.S. By the Constitution are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. The right of the citizens to vote shall not be denied. And so these are the things that in the U.S. Constitution that prevent the left from controlling the have-nots. And so that's why the left hates America, because, and that's why also the left wants to pack the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court will back up the Constitution, which prevents the left from securing all the what they have in mind for the serfs. So let's ask Rick what he thinks of the speech the other night of President Biden. Rick, what's your opinion of that speech?
Well, amongst the things that stand out are some of the willful misrepresentations that, you know, white nationalism is somehow the most serious form of domestic terrorism. This is ludicrous. When put in the context of what's actually happened over the past year, with literally hundreds of millions of dollars in property being destroyed by Antifa and BLM and so forth, and you know, none of this being called out during the speech. So there's no equanimity with respect to addressing, you know, that topic. I guess, you know, the degree to which Biden has, you know, followed to the T, you know, the narrative set forth by, you know, what were previously regarded as kind of, you know, extreme leftist Democrats, has attracted voluminous commentary in the Wall Street Journal, the National Review, and elsewhere. And you know, I won't regurgitate any of that, except to say that it's clear that they are sharpening the tools they're going to need to enforce the diktats of the administrative state. And in particular, this, you know, $60 billion or thereabouts to hire more IRS you know, tax auditors and beef up the IRS. And this is a weapon with a twofold purpose. Allegedly, they claim to want to recover more of what they regard as unpaid tax liabilities. But in reality, the threat of an audit for an individual or a corporation is a very serious threat. And it's a threat I would argue that they will use repeatedly in the coming years to bring corporations and individuals into line. And with all of the measures they are proposing, whether it's, you know, the severe regulations that are part and parcel of their Green New Deal, because that's actually what the infrastructure bill is about, right? It's a repackaged form of the Green New Deal in many areas. They're going to resort to very severe enforcement measures, you know, even as they're letting criminals out of jail, mind you. But they're going to resort to very severe enforcement measures to remake the U.S. economy into a vision of what they believe the U.S. should be, you know, a green energy-based, non-fossil fuel-based economy. So, you know, I don't think the stock markets recognize this yet, but for as many subsidies and so forth that are going to provide it to stimulate green energy usage and control pollution and so forth, you know, there will be other regulatory measures that will effectively kill or greatly diminish other industries that they view as standing in the way. Obviously, the whole fossil fuel industry and all of the industries that support it, the equipment manufacturers, you know, the pipeline manufacturers, the refineries, all of that is within the purview of their broader target of converting the United States and ultimately the world to, you know, zero emissions threshold. in a very short time frame, I might add. And J.P. Morgan and other firms have come out with reports, trying to estimate the cost of all this and whether it's even possible. And the general conclusion is that not only is it not possible to replace all fossil fuel usage with green energy forms in any reasonable time frame, the cost of it is astronomical and far beyond the costs that have been cited thus far. So you can consider, the quote-unquote infrastructure bill as, an opening gambit, which will be followed up by other similar bills or administrative measures that are designed to achieve this holy grail.
Rick, what are the consequences of this going forward?
Well, some industries will grow. The EV business is going to prosper mightily. The federal government has declared that they want to build 500,000 charging stations across the U.S. That's about 10 times the current number. That's big. So anybody in that business that has a competitive product is going to prosper. But equally, the regulations being contemplated to, discourage business in oil and other fossil fuels will mean that the price of gasoline is going to rise significantly. Already has, but that will continue. It's a supply and demand issue and a regulatory issue as well. Taxes on fuel usage will obviously go up. Certainly, it's already happening at the state levels. Here in Washington State, they're proposing a huge increase in the gasoline tax. So those businesses will suffer, and shareholders of those businesses will suffer. So while nascent technologies may receive a big boost and shareholders in those technologies will prosper from that, shareholders of fossil fuel companies and all the attendant industries, which is very, very significant, is a very large part of the U.S. economy, will suffer mightily. So, the implications for the stock market are obviously very mixed. On the one hand, you'll have some companies skyrocketing. Others, on the other hand, you'll have established companies that wither. And I would add that suggesting that, the world will become, the dominant supplier of some of these products is a dicey proposition. Just for example, in the area of solar panels, I think China has 70-80% market share in global solar panels. So, is Biden actually suggesting that the United States is going to displace China in that product market? Apparently he is, but that won't happen. We will not be able to undercut China in that kind of product when they have such a huge head start.
Correct. Rick, thanks for that, and we'll see everybody else next week on the next edition of The Philosophical Angle.
Thank you for joining us on The Philosophical Angle podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join us for the next installment.